le président. Bonjour, Mme Tantelin.
Bonjour, madame.
Bonjour, madame. Avant de poser ma première question, telle que je l'écris, j'aimerais vous faire part d'un vraiment bref résumé sur la situation des techniciens en laboratoire pour la grappe optimale à Montréal, puis aussi des technologues en imagerie médicale du Royal Vic et de l'Hôpital Général de Montréal. Donc, en résumé, là, présentement, il y a de la détresse psychologique critique chez les techniciens de laboratoire et chez ces technologues en imagerie médicale due à une surcharge de travail imposée. On constate qu'il y a un haut taux d'absentéisme que nous relions, nous, à la surcharge, et ces absences sont peu, voire pas remplacées. Donc, il y a des fermetures de salles d'examen en imagerie médicale et des fermetures de bancs d'analyse de laboratoire de façon ponctuelle présentement. Aussi, présentement, toujours, aucune planification stratégique de la main-d'œuvre nous a été présentée, et ce, depuis les trois dernières années. Il y a eu plusieurs réorganisations résultant des coupures de postes qui ont eu pour conséquence une perte de l'expertise. En radiologie, on a fait nos devoirs, on a regardé. Les embauches semblent quasi inexistantes et pour les laboratoires, on nous a informé qu'il y aurait 60 nouvelles embauches. Cependant, selon les documents qui nous sont transmis par le CUSM, nous constatons présentement qu'il y a 16 techniciens qui sont embauchés, ça c'est en recul depuis le 28 avril, et 16 techniciens non diplômés, qu'on appelle les externes, et 8 techniciens de laboratoire. Alors on se demande où sont les autres. Donc là, on voudrait faire part de nos inquiétudes. C'est-à-dire, devant la somme de ces problématiques-là, les membres APTS et leurs représentants syndicaux sont inquiets du risque sur la qualité en service, en laboratoire et en imagerie médicale, pour le Royal Vic général, puis les laboratoires, c'est la grappe optimale, soient compromises parce qu'on leur demande de faire toujours plus avec moins. La situation est tellement grave que le personnel APTS ont signé des pétitions dans lesquelles il est mentionné clairement qu'il décline toute responsabilité quant aux incidents, exemple mauvais diagnostic par le manque de ressources, délai des diagnostics, maladie du sang ou cancer, etc., pouvant survenir en raison de cette surcharge et vu du manque de personnel. Donc, devant ce constat, une question s'impose, mais juste avant de vous la poser, je voudrais pouvoir justement déposer au board ces pétitions-là, qu'on a déjà déposées aux ressources humaines. Je ne sais pas si je peux m'avancer.
Oui, certainement.
Oui. Donc, la question, c'est quelles sont les mesures entreprises par le CUSM afin d'attirer, retenir, on parle bien d'attraction, rétention, la main-d'œuvre dans le contexte actuel et futur de pénurie dans les laboratoires et en imagerie médicale?
Okay. Il y a beaucoup d'éléments, Mme Étienne, puis je ne pense pas qu'on va être en mesure de répondre à chacun des éléments que vous avez apportés. Je demanderais peut-être quand même à Mme Dubé, notre directrice des ressources humaines, si peut-être elle veut amener quelques éléments de réponse à votre question puis à la problématique que vous soulevez.
Alors, bonjour tout le monde. Alors, effectivement, il y a toutes sortes de problématiques ou de perceptions de problématiques qui sont soulevées par la PTS. Il y a des rencontres qui se font entre la direction des ressources humaines, la PTS et les personnes impliquées. Pour ce qui est de la question spécifique du recrutement, alors, il y a de nombreuses initiatives qui ont été mises de l'avant, que ce soit des visites à l'intérieur de toutes les écoles concernées dès la première année pour que les gens viennent travailler chez nous. On les embauche même dans différents types d'emplois pour éventuellement les retenir plus tard dans le bon titre d'emploi. On leur permet de travailler un nombre d'heures. On est extrêmement flexible dans la possibilité de travailler ou non en fonction de ce qu'ils souhaitent et en fonction du lieu de travail qu'ils souhaitent. On a d'ailleurs fait plusieurs embauches. Malheureusement, je n'ai pas les chiffres exacts. Je comprends que Mme Étienne en soulève quelques-uns. On pourrait faire la comparaison entre nous deux, je suis toujours ouverte à le faire. Il y a eu plusieurs embauches de notre côté. On calcule que près de 90% des demandes d'embauche qui avaient été présentées ont été complétées. Donc, il nous resterait une dizaine de demandes d'embauche à compléter. On parle d'à peu près 6 embauches à faire. Alors, je comprends qu'il y a une différence entre ce qui est mentionné par Mme Étienne et ce que je vous soulève. Alors, je soumets qu'on pourrait en rediscuter plus avant avec le syndicat directeur.
Fait que j'allais continuer une discussion en relation de travail avec le syndicat sur ces enjeux-là.
Tout à fait.
Puis peut-être nous tenir informés.
Effectivement.
Madame Tien, je pense que vous aviez une autre question.
Oui. Allô? Ah. Bon, le 24 avril dernier, il y a eu un code d'évacuation qu'on appelle un code vert dans les laboratoires situés dans le Glen Run Block E, suite à un petit incendie là, qui a été déclaré dans une sécheuse là, dans ce même bloc-là. Donc, suite à ça, plusieurs, tout le monde est en question, qu'est-ce qui arrive, juste un instant, je reprends, là, pour la protection du spécimen, du personnel et de la population, c'est-à-dire qu'il y a des bandes, il y a de la ventilation, tout est gardé en pression négative. Et justement, à cause de ce code rouge-là de feu, bien, tout ferme. Donc, et les gens doivent évacuer, donc on se demandait aussi, donc c'est ça, donc, s'il n'y a plus de ventilation négative pour justement garder une certaine protection ou garder le spécimen stérile ou éviter la propagation, que ce soit de virus ou de bactéries, telles que par exemple la méningite qui peuvent être analysées ou la tuberculose, on se demande justement est-ce que pour les laboratoires, là, puis pas juste non plus au Glen, est-ce que le CUSM a un plan d'urgence qui inclut la protection des spécimens, mais aussi du personnel puis de la population qui visite l'hôpital? Donc, c'est la question.
Merci. C'est une question très technique. Personnellement, je ne possède pas la réponse à ça, mais je vais demander à M. Pierre-Marc Legris, qui est notre directeur des services techniques, s'il peut apporter peut-être des éléments de réponse. Puis, c'est ça, l'incident du 24 avril, il y a eu un feu qui a débuté dans une sécheuse à linge, simplement, à l'Institut de recherche. Et ça a amené, ça a été un incendie qui a été rapidement contrôlé par les pompiers. Il y a, par contre, c'est un événement qui est sérieux, et puis qui est un événement non seulement sentinelle, mais qui est un événement qui fait l'objet d'une étude présentement, d'un débriefing du personnel. Il y a eu un débriefing à chaud, puis un débriefing à froid. Il y a un plan d'action qui a été présenté au comité de direction cette semaine. Il y a aussi eu, puis vous ne l'avez pas mentionné, on a eu une vingtaine d'employés, surtout du laboratoire. Je pense qu'il y avait un médecin aussi, puis peut-être quelqu'un d'ailleurs, qui ont été pris dans un ascenseur, dans une autre partie de l'édifice. Alors, donc, on regarde ça sérieusement, parce que les gens étaient quand même pris une cinquantaine de minutes, puis il a fallu que les pompiers de Montréal interviennent avec leurs escouades spéciales pour être en mesure de sortir ces personnes-là de l'ascenseur où elles étaient prises. Fait que, clairement, que, M. Legris, avez-vous, par rapport à la question spécifique, qu'est-ce qui arrive à la protection des spécimens, du personnel et de la population par rapport à des risques potentiels d'infection quand il y a un code rouge ou un code vert et que la pression négative est coupée? Je ne sais pas si vous avez. Peut-être que vous n'avez pas les éléments, on reviendra une autre fois, mais je vous laisse aller.
Non, effectivement, je n'arrive pas à tous les éléments de réponse aujourd'hui, mais spécifiquement pour la protection du personnel, en fait, on a des plans de mesures d'urgence lors de code rouge, lors de code vert, donc on a des protocoles d'établis. Avec les services de sécurité sur l'ensemble des sites du CUSUM. Et puis, lorsqu'il y a un code rouge majeur et puis qu'on doit évacuer, donc on procède à un code vert, évidemment, on travaille en collaboration avec le service des incendies de Montréal. C'est eux qui prennent la relève lorsqu'il y a un sinistre majeur. En fait, donc, ces protocoles-là sont établis pour s'assurer de la protection du personnel. Comme dans l'exemple du 24 avril, le code vert a été lancé à l'ensemble du bâtiment de l'Institut de recherche du bloc E, où se trouvent les laboratoires, en fait, par mesure préventive par le service incendie de Montréal. Donc, évidemment, les services de sécurité du CUSUM collaborent et procèdent à l'évacuation du personnel et s'assurent que tout le monde est en sécurité. Donc, au niveau des spécimens, malheureusement, je n'aurai pas la réponse à cette question-là. Et pour les aspects plus techniques, au niveau de la ventilation, lorsqu'il y a des codes rouges, les systèmes sont programmés pour, effectivement, diminuer le plus possible les taux de ventilation pour éviter un apport d'oxygène dans les bâtiments où il y a des incendies. Encore là, en détail, je ne pourrais pas commenter par rapport aux installations spécifiques du laboratoire, mais c'est surtout au Cidlen où on a des systèmes relativement récents. Les protocoles de code rouge au niveau de la ventilation sont programmés. Donc, normalement, tout est sécuritaire pour les employés et le personnel. Mais je pourrais quand même aussi revenir plus en détail sur ces questions-là, spécifiquement.
Parfait. Peut-être qu'on pourrait avoir un petit topo écrit qu'on pourrait communiquer à la PTF, si vous pourriez en faire mention lors de la prochaine réunion du conseil d'administration à l'Assemblée publique. Prochaine question, I've got Mrs. Evelyn Seligman, who wanted to ask a question. Madam Seligman.
Two questions. They're related questions. I just want to say as an little introduction that I clearly remember the day in December 1970, the day on which Medicare began in Canada. Now we've seen many, many changes since then in the medical system, but what will the future bring and how much will it cost the patient? So anyway, recently, as you know, many of the gynecologists, or most of the gynecologists from the VIC have opted to have their offices in private clinics at 5100 de Maisonneuve, known officially, by the way, as Centre Medical Brunswick at Glen. And one or more have moved to Cour Montréal. So we know that many pediatricians from the MUHC, from the children's, have set up private offices quite some time ago at 5100. And now the move of other specialties to private clinics at 5100 has raised some questions on the part of the public. I am putting forward two questions really on behalf of the Montreal General Patients Committee. Our vibrant committee is actually a microcosm of all the patients served by the MUHC. So my first question is this. Some of you may already know that there's a laboratory located on the ground floor of 5100 Maisonneuve. So if a patient needs a blood test, and if the patient chooses to go to this lab for the blood test, there is a charge of $10, and they give you a flyer to that effect. So patients are well aware when they walk in that if they want their blood test taken there, it's $10, all right, or any specimen. Okay, a fee of $10 exists to transport the patient's blood or any other specimen to the hospital. Yes, patients have the option of bringing their specimens directly to the hospital themselves, free of charge, of course. That's good. However, not all patients have the mobility to walk from 5100 to the RBH. And to go to the hospital on another day or at another time is obviously very inconvenient for many patients. I would like to know whether other private clinics, for example, those at the Queen Elizabeth Medical Center, do they charge patients for blood tests? And perhaps I'm naive, but is this even permitted? Is this considered an auxiliary service, such as the ones disallowed by the previous health minister? And also, is it ethical or reasonable for blood tests at 5100 to be a profit center while many patients can ill afford to pay the fee? Yes, it's only $10. It's not a lot of money. But what if the patient has to see her gynecologist, for example, over the course of many weeks? When one considers the thousands of dollars will profit the lab and perhaps the physicians who have offices there, and I'm not against doctors making money, right? But there's a need to ask, is this fee justifiable? Okay, that's my first question.
Okay, so I'm gonna ask that Sidi Rovitz, our medical director, to answer your questions.
I have a microphone
batch.
Pardon me? I have a microphone. Mention that we spent quite a long time discussing this at the Central Users Committee on May 13th. It wasn't at the MGH group, but it was at the Central Users Committee, so I'm sure that you remember that I was there, and also Marie-Josée Bourassin, who's the manager of the outpatient area for women's health. But I'll try to answer your questions again, and just to remind you that what is allowed by the ministry is actually on the website of the ministry. So I have a copy here if you'd like it, okay, in terms of what's allowed and what isn't. So it's very clear that blood or other biological samples are acquired in a physician's office outside of a public center, and then that specimen to be there is an allowance so that the doctor can charge for the transport of that to the laboratory. They can't charge for the actual procurement if it's done by the personnel that's working for that physician's office, okay? And that fee, as is written on the ministry site, can be anywhere from $5 to $15, depending on the nature of the specimen, okay? If that clinic or doctor's office, which is outside of the hospital, decides to outsource the blood procurement or the sampling activity, then obviously the fee depends on the outsourcing laboratory, okay? So that is a different thing, and the ministry does allow for the billing to be done according to whatever laboratory this is outsourced to, okay? So the issue of 5100, it's a private clinic and it is outsourced, so there could be a fee. Now, at the Queen Elizabeth, I believe that for the part of the Queen Elizabeth that is within the public sphere, so there is a GMF there, there is no charge for blood taking. However, for other clinics that are not part of the GMF, there is a fee, according to the rules that are established by the ministry. Okay, I don't know about other clinics. And again, perhaps the question could be asked also specifically of the laboratory that is located in 5100 and or any or the Queen Elizabeth for that matter. Okay? So there are actually two different things at 5100. There is a laboratory which is the outsourced part, okay? So patients could go there if they so desire. But within the gynecology clinics themselves, which are run by the physicians, specimens that are produced there. There is the possibility of them being transported, not by the patient, but transported, and then in that case there is a fee that's allowed. Okay, so I'm not sure if that's clearer, right, so there's the outsourced service, and then there's a service that is provided within the doctor's office, and they are allowed to charge for the transport. Yeah, exactly. Okay, is that helpful, Evelyn?
Yes, that's fine. I think Madame Seligman had a second question.
Yes.
Thank you. It's related. It has to do with 5100. I was told by one of the physicians at 5100 that there will be a fee for ultrasound. So we did talk about this at the central committee meeting. When they eventually have the equipment, right now there's no ultrasound, not yet. So I was just going to say that Dr. Storowitz and Marie-Josée Bourassa did come to a meeting. So they did come to a meeting with Central Patients Committee to address this issue, among others, having to do with the private clinics at 5100. We were told that it is still early and not a great deal is known yet about the fees that will be charged in the future. So I wanted to know, I guess maybe it's still too early, Dr. Sidoris, but will patients be charged for all the various tests that could be given there at 5100? Now, we're all told that, thank goodness, patients will have the option of going to the hospital to avoid being charged for ultrasounds or other tests. But again, I have to say, myself included, it's extremely inconvenient. If a patient is seeing her gynecologist at 5100 and then has to make a special trip to the hospital, it's more than inconvenient. You know, it's really a hardship for some patients who cannot just walk over to the hospital, especially in winter, although there is now a tunnel. Is it ready? I don't know. Not quite. By the way, some of you may not know that neurology shares the fourth floor at 5100, the Maisonneuve, with gynecology, and I believe that other specialists will be moving there as well, just for your information. And so my question again is, what's going to happen when they do have the equipment? What will be the fees for patients, and will they be affordable for the average person?
Mentioned to you when we met, in terms of ultrasound, there is no ultrasound being done right now in the gynecology clinic, and I'm not sure, because again, it's outside of the hospital, what the plans are of the physicians who are there, but let's say that they did decide to develop ultrasound, As you know, when Dr. Baguette brought these rules into place, there is ultrasound that is done by radiologists is now covered by RADQ, and ultrasound done by non-radiologists is not. So that's how the ministry has set up the fees. So, if theoretically the gynecologist decided to set up the ability to do ultrasound there, then yes, the patients would be charged because that's the way the system works right now. But at the present time, there is no ultrasound equipment there, and I'm not aware that there are plans to develop it. But again, I'm not running the private clinic, so I don't know. You have to ask them directly.
Yeah, the gynecologist whom I see, at 5100 told me that there will be ultrasounds there. So this is just for one physician. They're not set up yet.
The question should really go to the private clinic, I think, for that, because I don't know.
Thank you
very much. Madame Marie-Jo Pires.
Good morning to everyone. I'm Marie-Jo Pires from the Users Committee at the Neuro. And my co-chair, Nicole Savoie. So we have a question about accessibility to the Neuro building. So as we all know, those of us who do the Neuro very well, it's on a hill, on a slope. And with the RBH gone, accessibility became a complicated matter, simply because there's no more access on flat ground. So those on wheelchair and reduced mobility have a lot of challenges. Parking is, in this winter, it's snow, and it's hard to park because there's no parking other than the one that's provided by the RBH, which is on the hill coming down with a wheelchair, very difficult to maneuver. The one in the parking at the top of the hill, which is the one where the stadium is, there is some handicapped spots there, but the person would have to push a wheelchair up that ramp. There's a location to drop off someone, and accessibility is blocked by a dumpster. The city has busy planted their bikes this summer and took away some more spots. So it's a challenge. So what my question is, what are the actions the board is going to take to improve the physical access to the Neuro for patients with mobility issues? And how can the users committee of the Neuro help you with it, the process?
Thank you very much for your question. What would be your recommendation? I'm sure you have an answer to your question.
My wish list? Open the building to access the VIC again. In the olden days, when you parked at the VIC, you could get access through the building. So if you're on a wheelchair, you could access the building. Now it's not possible.
So you would like us to reopen the Royal Victoria to access?
Just the access, the door. That's one solution I
think. Okay, we have a door at the M&M which is locked that could be unlocked, that's what you're saying?
No, the door's not locked. There's a corridor, there's a bridge that goes over from the M&I over to the Neuro, to the VIC.
But that's from the old Royal VIC.
Exactly.
So you would have to enter the VIC and then could you go to the M&I?
That or?
So you're asking us to reopen the VIC?
Not the building, just the access.
Okay, I don't know if that's feasible.
I don't know if it's feasible. I mean, I think people know that the accesses are people who run the building, the planners of the building. Other options?
I don't know.
Well, what I find is the most obvious option right now, because I think you're not going to be able to use the VIC. There's a dumpster right on the corner at the top of the hill, and I went there on Monday morning, and it could be moved. Beside, because there's an entrance on a flat level and the dumpster is sitting on the only part of the road where the road is exactly at the same, the road meets the edge. So people who would come on their own in a wheelchair, in an electronic wheelchair, could probably access there. But the dumpster, there is a space where the dumpster could be moved right beside the building.
Is that the area where we succeeded in getting work done by the City of Montreal last year? Is that in the same area?
Yes.
After I wrote to Madame, to the mayor?
Correct.
Yes? Okay, so we'll take a look, okay, and maybe you should discuss, I think, was that already discussed yesterday or at the users committee? No? Okay, so Pierre-Marc will take a look, and okay. We'll see what we can do.
Now, just to say, we do have automatic access door at the university level to get into the building.
Yeah.
but it's very challenging because it is on a hill. So the dumpster area is much better because there is a flat area where people can access.
So we'll take a
thank you so much.
So I would ask you to maybe to speak to Pierre-Marc Le Gris and maybe even organize a visit and take a look at it. So, Mr. McCutcheon.
Good morning. This is really not a question. It's for you, Dr. Filler, and for the board. It's about the air conditioning in Montreal in general, but it's not in the form of a question. It'll just give you an update on how this first started. Last summer, the MGN Patients Committee inquired about installing air conditioning in some patient's room at the heat, at the height of the heat and the heat wave. I first felt that the hardship on the patient and the staff, because I went on some floors, and believe me, after 5 minutes, your clothes were soaked, it was so hot, and you could tell with the staff that were dragging, and they were having a real hard time. When we were offering to buy 10 air conditioners to put in the window, we were told we couldn't do it, not possible, due to a contract with a private firm that takes care of the existing air conditioners that are there, which are floor models. They do the installation, the removal, the cleaning, and the storage when they have to be removed for the winter. So we were told, that's it. We didn't go any further for a simple fact. September came around in October, and the air conditioning problem went away because it wasn't so warm. When that person that Paroi that told us that it was not possible is no longer working there, been replaced. Now for some good news. Yesterday we had a PC meeting, a patients committee meeting at the Montreal General Hospital, and we had two guests, Madame Alfonso and Pierre-Marc Le Gris. Madame Alfonso updated us on the visioning progress with the government of the Montreal General Hospital. She gave us a few things that are going around. There's quite a bit of work being done, and there's also a lot of work with the government. And like we said, we're happy to hear what we heard. It's coming. It's moving. What I keep saying, it's moving at government speed, so we're not going to see that stuck for a while. But at least it's moving. And Madame Alfonso told us that she will keep us updated as it goes along with this. Quite a bit of work to be done, obviously. Now for some update on this file, the air condition, some good news. I'm very happy to say that the administration have picked up the file this year, and there's been some activity on it, quite a bit actually. The electricity needed to support a whole 125 new air condition and a whole hospital, the wiring, the grid, that has to be looked at. It has to be evaluated. That work has already been done. They already also find out which panel had to be changed, which electrical panel had to be changed to support air condition. The rooms on the fourth floor, the 11th floor, through 15, the 17, the 18, approximately 125 rooms have been identified so far. This is a major work to be done, and will be done, but it will be done in waves. The first wave is already in progress, and we were told that we can expect 40 more units to be installed over and above the existing one, and that will be completely done as soon as possible. And as everybody knows, time is of the essence because of summer. If we wait too long, it's time wasted, really, and patients do suffer. And the second and third wave will be done following on, depending on the resource and whatever we can find, but it will be done eventually. This is major improvement and benefit for the patient. I would personally like to congratulate the administration and all those who are taking part in this project for picking up the file and running with it this year and promising up to do 40 rooms before the summer's over. I think it's great time that this project goes on. it's fantastic that the administration took upon itself to go along and do it. And in the name of the patients and the patient committee, I'd like to thank you for your work and to keep up the good work. Thank you very much.